Chapter 9, Day of Pain.
So, miss, I'm sorry. What was your name again?
This was a crude tactic to posture oneself as dominant in the conversation. There are several ways with which to react that could determine the first impression of intent. Any number of these could be used against her. She re-evaluated her end goal and went with the most beneficial response. The entire decision-making process had to be done within a second, or else the pause in conversation could be seen as negative on Lahara's part.
It's Lahara, and yours?
Mayor Gray, nice to meet your acquaintance.
He extended his hand with a smile, but knew already by her tone that she was either arrogant or confident. Neither one was useful to Gray.
Likewise.
She met him with an equally tasteful grin, acknowledging how she could see through his attempts.
Now, on to business.
It could be read into that he was attempting to control the conversation with this line, but truth be told, it was a natural pacing after Lahara's response. She was not worried about it, as it was his office, and on his terms that they met, it was only reasonable to assume it would be on his terms that the conversation progressed. However, he had left an opening, and she took it.
Yes, I'd like to discuss a potential trade deal.
Yes, my assistant had informed me.
He had mistakenly positioned himself into the passive role in this power struggle. If she hadn't seen the opening, he would have moved forward with framing his words so carefully as to lead Lahara into voicing her intents more lightly, taking away the potential aggression. Now, Lahara had the opening she needed to remain professional while still pressuring the mayor. If this had been a match of will and reflex, Lahara would now be in position for a kill strike. It was not, however, as she still needed her opponent. All that was accomplished was the building of the foundations for which they now both stood. No real progress had been made. Mayor Gray thought it easiest to just end the talks right here and now, as he had the socio-economic standing to simply turn her away. This line of thinking was halted with the echoing of what Chief Rether had said to him earlier. Instead of pressing, Lahara simply waited for Gray to continue, allowing him time to collect his thoughts and prepare a volley. Predictions and counters were set aside for the sake of information sharing. This was not meant to be a contest, but a collaboration. Gray decided to push her this time.
I would like to know why you think I should listen to you about this.
Surely your assistant informed you of my standing.
Lords of Teardrop Isle? You mean former standing? Now all you have is the money you collected from being forced to sell off your land.
I am in a unique position, shed of my previous obligations to the land.
And what makes you think this is a strength?
Gray was partially curious, but his words were designed so as to damage, not question. Dodging the rhetoric.
What makes you think it isn't? All I see here is another person, whom I will judge based on the merits of their actions.
She paused as if to let him speak. The abrupt change was something Gray wasn't ready for, and as he began formulating, she continued as the silence was her objective.
I see a land in dire needs, a people of falling aspirations, and a city that is slowly becoming a graveyard.
She stared him down.
I see a person in need of help.
The speech was grand, he'd admit, but this was a business transaction to him, and understanding the desires of all parties was not only beneficial to the agreement, but to his curiosity.
But what do you want?
I want to help.
No, that's not what I mean. Why is it you who is coming to me? Altruism can be a selfish motivation, yes, but what is there to gain for you? I cannot believe you would not stand to gain from this transaction, and until I understand it, I will have trouble trusting your judgment.
Everything is a series of gains and losses to you, isn't it? Just like to those that ran these corporations into the ground, belittling their own resources with poor treatment because of gains and losses, numbers don't mean everything.
You didn't answer me, though.
This time, Gray stopped, leaving Lahara spent after delivering her counter. She had not yet decided what to say next, so she took the back seat and understood that he was now doing to her what she had done to him.
Truth is, everyone wants something. Safety, happiness, comfort, life, ambition, or anything that can result in those. Of course, I'm generalizing. It doesn't make what I say any less true. People came to this island. They wanted to because they wanted the job to earn the money to afford housing for themselves and their families. They wanted the happiness from the environment, from the housing provided. I want to keep my job. I want to keep my pride and dignity. So I want to do right by the people in their eyes. So I want to fix the economy of Cowtip. See? There are people here that want to hunt, find employment or people, to leave, to protect, to uncover truth, to have a home, to break the monotony of life, and ultimately want to survive. I think I now know what you want.
Lahara was surprised to be hearing this from the mayor. She had misread him.
To help.
To help because it makes you feel good, feel better. You know why? I think I know the reason.
He had honestly just come up with the theory while he was talking about his own desires.
You want to feel useful again.
She had enough of this pondering.
Does it really matter?
Excuse me?
If you need a reason to trust me, and that reason is what I want, then you have it. But I feel like you are just wasting my time. I get it. You're a mayor, and I'm a tourist. But look, you are a mayor of a single territory, one in decline. My family was very well connected on a much different plane. The biggest thing I learned from my family's fall from nobility is that it shouldn't have mattered in the first place. You think it makes you better because of a title, that this gives you the right to posture yourself above someone else?
No.
Then listen to me.
I'm here, aren't I?
You're here, but you aren't even paying attention to what is going on. This myopia is almost assuredly how the island fell into this death spiral.
I think you've forgotten.
My place. See, you didn't listen to a word I just said.
Regret filled Mayor Gray's thoughts. He began to see mistakes he hadn't considered before, such as talking to her, expecting an easy deal to be struck which favored Cimeterium's well-being. He hadn't thought of providing a reasoning. Lahara didn't relent.
You fail to see how this is an olive branch. You are the one that needs assistance. I can just let you go, but I stuck my neck out to get to you and talk this over. So, do you want to talk numbers, or do you want Cimeterium to be crushed under the weight of your own impotence?
This day was not going well for Mayor Gray. Mental anguish was the primary consistency of his well-being since the sun arose.
I'll need my financial advisors and budget committee. Honestly, I should contact the UPIO's Foreign Affairs Board about this, too. It's standard operating procedure for a deal such as this. I'll vouch for the removal of the tariffs to the mainland UPIO ports by advocating for direct trade to the island. That should draw some attention and the desire of many businesses. What exactly did you have in mind, though?
I'm talking about your plans for the other side of the ridge.
That's untapped. Everyone knows there's no reason to go there except hiking and hunting.
This entire island is fertile beyond belief. The soil is what is untapped.
You mean to farm it?
Tell me what you know of Teardrop.
Pharmaceuticals and bioengineered crops. Thriving industry there, the biochemical one.
Lahara was nodding in approval as a teacher would a student, but she was keeping secret the fact that farming and manual labor were well below the normal numbers.
We developed the potential farmland on the other side of the ridge with Teardrop's crops. The companies will be drawn here for the fertile land and the tariff-free transport you are offering. This will bring jobs and other companies from Teardrop expanding to Cimeterium. We ship the crops back to Teardrop from Cowtip, maybe allow competition between shipping startups, and allow the fishers here to start selling their catch in Teardrop as well. Then you regulate the fishing licenses and raise the price. This way, the most equipped companies can fish efficiently in your high-quality waters just fine.
Wait a minute. You're leaving trade deal territory and entering local law territory.
I understand you will need to run the trade deal plans by those in the UPIO mainland, but you can regulate and set up for it without them. I don't think I need to tell you how much you need to enforce some stricter regulations on your hunting and fishing industries.
The protesters had done that for her. Gray wasn't sure if she knew of the complexities of the situation.
It isn't that simple. I can take the trade deal, but the regulations would need to be discussed after the details of our talks reach the public.
She smiled as he had already conceded cooperation.
That works for me. When do you think we'll be able to discuss this?
It was now that he realized he had already agreed to her terms without negotiating. Things seemed too skewed in his favor for his comfort, though.
There are some pressing issues on the island currently. I'll make contact about the trade deal with representatives later tonight. I can't say for certain whether they'll agree to it, though if you'd like, you can make travel to them, mainland, after the storm is over. That would certainly increase your chances of success. I'll inform them of your wishes, and they will be more fit to discuss the logistics with you.
He slid a paper over.
If you could leave your contact information now, I must be going before this storm arrives.
As Lahara negotiated, Dahlia was near the edge of the city. Just outside of its boundaries, she was stepping through grass damp with dew of the prior night, as it was covered with the shade of the nearby buildings for most of the day, from dawn till the arrival of clouds. They had only come in recently, with the wind, in a way that she felt meant the storm was nearer than she had presumed. She had made her decision. She would seek out Shivra Njarl herself and see for herself what he was like. Before coming to the island, she caught wind of him, but she had no idea what kind of person he might be. Dahlia was unsure how to approach him or how he'd react. Reaching into her pocket, she remembered Anya giving her a number and telling her to let her know if she would do anything crazy just before she got onto the bus to enter Cimeterium the first time. Her head nodded side to side.
No,
she said to herself.
I'm doing this on my own.
As Alexander was leaving Cimeterium into the ridge floor village, Tulver was inching his way behind Miles, another member of Group 1, just leaving the border of Cimeterium towards Fisher's Paradise. Maxwell remained inside Cimeterium, avoiding the conflict that seemed to be on the cusp of arriving. All other members of the gambling ring were making their way in one path or another towards the fishermen Maxwell arrived to Cowtip with to pay their way off the island with the funds they've accumulated thus far. Since this was a cheaper option, it would mean that each member would have a small amount of spending money so as not to be completely broke after reaching the mainland of the UPIO. With Kasumi and Gorik awaiting their arrival, Miles was within detectable range. From behind the shacks they were hiding among, Gorik looked over to Kasumi and nodded. She understood that in order for their ambush to be most effective, they'd need to deal with the closer one as efficiently as possible while simultaneously striking the farther target. Without knowing what abilities they'd have, they had to make sure to keep their distance. This was not a problem for either Gorik or Kasumi, as their abilities would allow for just such combat. Gorik would rely on his 5 guns of Fury Hatsu to manipulate his 5 revolvers he carries around him to increase his potential firepower. Kasumi would rely on her modernized Ichival Hatsu to conjure a specialized rifle to keep her distance. While doing this, she would conjure fabled warrior Achilles to serve both her and Gorik as their front line. With his strength, he would be able to keep them busy with close-range combat, while both her and Gorik kept a safe distance before moving in for the arrest once they were taken out fully. Before they would begin, Gorik would check to make sure they were attacking the right people. Knowing how close the two were, he began to use compass to the truth several times. Using manipulation, he can ask his compass a question about a person, and it will point to the person within a 2-mile radius that fits the information gleaned through that question. If there is more than one, however, it will not work. This ability isn't as useful in an interrogation setting, as oftentimes the goal is not to identify the person being interrogated, but to gather information from the one being interrogated. Quietly, he spoke.
Is there someone who killed within the past few days here?
The compass did not move. With this revelation, he looked over at Kasumi, communicating as much as he could silently with his facial expression. Either they both were killers, or none of them were. They still weren't sure if they were actually behind the massacre they discovered, as it could have occurred while Baruka was asleep.
Are there Nen users that ran the gambling ring here?
Once again, it didn't move. He assumed they must both be Nen users, but he wished to confirm their role in the crime ring. Specificity would be required.
Is the leader of the gambling ring here?
The compass immediately reacted. It pointed past Miles, up towards Tulva standing at the edge of the grass. Gorik pointed in his general direction and mimed a crown. Kasumi understood. Miles was beginning to move towards Fisher's Paradise. With his ability Facebreaker, he could charge Nen into his fist and pull it back, creating a vacuum effect that would pull in nearby objects and people to where his fist started at. His goal would be to use it to pull a person out from behind cover and punch them when in range. Still, he would need to move in relatively close for it to actually have an effect. Tulva knew he wouldn't stand a chance in close-range combat, so he stayed back, where Miles exceeded in fistfights. Kasumi conjured Achilles, and Gorik used his 5 guns ability. With Achilles running up towards Miles, both of the fighters were pleased to be meeting a close-range fight. Tulva, however, noticed Kasumi pop up while conjuring her rifle and Gorik with his floating revolvers. He stared down at a spot in front of Miles and conjured instant casino as cover. Before they began shooting, Tolva dove behind it as well. From a safe vantage point, Maxwell wondered if he should take this chance now to flee during the chaos. His only goal was to avoid arrest, but he felt a strange obligation to help Tolva after he had finally given him a job. He also wanted to make sure to act in any way he could to prevent loss of life. The police may have been lethally armed, but they were not killers. They were upholding the law and sought to arrest the perpetrators for the crimes they were investigating. With the door to Instant Casino facing away from the police, Tolva entered inside and gestured for Miles to enter as well, where they could buy time for the others to make it to the boat. Miles, however, wanted a fight. He wanted to act and protect Tolva with his ability. Waiting for their time to come was not something he desired. Achilles, with his thick armor, shield in hand and sword in his the other, was casually making his way towards the structure. Any non-major wounds he'd sustain would be able to heal, so long as they weren't his lone weak spot on his heel. Raising the shield on his left, he began to approach the corner, sword affixed in striking position. As Achilles made it to the corner, Miles used Facebreaker to pull him out, which Achilles positioned his shield first. With Achilles being sucked into range, Miles began his punch using the muscles in a full body movement. The punch connected, but it was not with flesh. Since Achilles had positioned his shield first in anticipation, he was pulled into Miles's attack shield first, and the fist collided with that instead, sending Achilles back a few feet but perfectly defended, while Miles sustained damage to his fist, limiting his combat ability. Tolva, inside, was not focused on defeating or winning the bout in any way. To him, victory would come from the rest of the members leaving Cowtip aboard the fishing boat that Maxwell entered on. Gorik and Kasumi decided to leave Miles to Achilles, while Kasumi would pepper the structure with her rifle, hopefully disorienting and distracting Tolva from Gorik, who was now leaving Fisher's Paradise to flank Miles and find the entrance into the structure to deal with Tolva one-on-one. All Tolva could think about was what the others were doing, hoping that they'd have almost made it by now. Chief Rether was positioned back, near the docks, as a fight of Nen would mean he'd be of little use to them. His purpose was to head them off before they could escape. As the chief was patrolling the docks, the others managed to make it to the place where the old man was preparing to leave.
You looking for any passengers, old man?
What was that?
A different person spoke this time.
We were told that you'd let us ride on the cheap.
Ah, now who told you that?
Maxwell Clerk.
Maxwell? Oh yes, a real lazy fella that one.
He rubbed his chin.
He said he offered to help and you wouldn't let him.
Listen, dumbass, who you gonna believe, him or me? Now, do you want to ride this boat or not?
Of course we do.
Then be prepared to work for it.
He told everyone this throughout the years. The truth of the matter was that he rarely actually asked for help, and when Maxwell had asked him instead, he only declined because he did not want to pay him. The boat would set off in less than 15 minutes to avoid the storm. Chief Rether was still patrolling, searching for any people that might be hiding nearby, unaware of the handful that had made it to the boat already. He was only one man, after all. As Law was leading Anya and Virgil to Jeremiah and his hideout in Fisher's Paradise, Anya's phone rang. Distressed, she hung up. Law could see the sense of excitement in her eyes, but worry was making the flicker of light murky. She spoke up.
I have to go. Let me know how to get in contact with you so I can help you out, though. I'm so sorry. It's just something came up and I need to go.
Jeremiah gave her a slip with an address on it. It was a shack address in Fisher's Paradise. The shack wouldn't be too hard to find, as they were all identified with a linear number system. This was because of the way the zoning was designed on the island. Each residential zone had its own address system for identification purposes. Advocates didn't want to change what was already there as Cimeterium shifted over to a different system to accommodate the large industrial boom it experienced years ago. Ironic, as now Cimeterium was being abandoned faster than the villages were. Law made sure to keep the offer on board.
Whatever you do, please think about what we are doing.
I like the idea of this and all,
Virgil added.
But I really want to see what she's up to. So,
he turned to follow Anya. The two of them left, leaving Jeremiah and Law alone again.
Well, Law, looks like it's just us two again.
They'll be back. In the meantime, you were right. They won't be enough.
Shortly after he spoke, they heard gunshots coming from not too far away. They began cautiously heading towards the commotion. As the gamblers were making their way to leave the island, the CPD were enacting counters to this, and everyone else was busy on the island of Cowtip. Whisk had been making his way out of the city to find Ksaxa. Before Maxwell had found himself now trapped between two opposing forces, and before the clouds of the storm had begun blocking the sun over Cimeterium, Whisk, atop Shinaga in his transformed state, had made it to where they'd thought it best to begin searching for him. Shen transformed back into normal size and began sniffing. Whisk started looking about the area, searching for signs of him. Partially eaten remains, trails of dragged blood, ragged fur, and even signs of defecation. Before long, Shen appeared to have caught the scent of something familiar. The two began walking throughout the trees, eyes darting all around for any sign of him. Without warning, they were startled by a voice.
"What are you looking for?"
The voice was quiet, calm, and disembodied. Whisk was never superstitious, but if he ever imagined an encounter with a ghost, it would be something like what he was experiencing now. Shen couldn't even pinpoint where it was coming from. Could it be coming from within their minds? They were thinking along the lines of the possibility that it was that or another reason, such as a complex system of reverberations around the tree.
"Who's talking?"
Whisk feared it might be too late for them, and they'd walked into a trap. Neither Shen nor Whisk knew what Shivranyal sounded like, and so they weren't sure if it could be him. If it was, they'd have planned to immediately run away. But first, they wanted to confirm if it was Shivra, so that they could communicate to Candy what he sounded like, or be there to confirm it was him in a later event. The voice now came from below and behind them.
"Hey, Whisk, are you two looking for me?"
Shen turned around as Whisk slowly began to look. It was Ksaxa, rising to a standing position behind them.
"What the hell was that, Ksaxa?"
"Sometimes I try and throw my voice to throw people off. Cool, isn't it?"
"Were you trying to throw us off?"
"No, no, no. I was just messing with you,"
he cheerfully declared while thinking to himself.
"And testing Shinaga's detection abilities. It is good to know that he can be fooled for both of our sakes in the future."
"Ksaxa,"
Whisk cut through.
"Are you looking for Shivranyarl?"
"Looking,"
he smiled.
"I found him. I just don't want to get too close. I want to watch him."
As Ksaxa took out his book and began jotting, Whisk wondered about the possibility that Shivra knew of Ksaxa's gaze upon himself. With Whisk's worry came Shen, coming near to comfort him. With someone as powerful as he, with what Whisk knew of him, he was certain that Shivra was equally observing Ksaxa.
"I think Shivra's watching you."
He stopped writing.
"I'm almost sure of it."
The sense of dread returned to Whisk.
"We have to leave. Get back to the city."
"Why?"
"Candy will be glad to have you safe."
"No, she won't. I can see that you know that's a lie as well."
"It's no lie."
"I can see it on your face if you're going to lie to me. At least convince yourself first, please."
He went back to writing. Whisk waited a while.
"I'm worried about you, Ksaxa."
"Oh."
He didn't bother to put the writing on hiatus this time.
"Why's that?"
"I've seen what Shiver is capable of."
"So have I."
"And you aren't going to keep your distance?"
"I'm keeping my distance right now, as a matter of fact. You're the one who isn't, actually."
"Ksaxa, I don't even know what that means."
"It means you're thinking too literally. Don't think of distance as the length of space in between you and him. Like you said, he's watching us."
Whisk realized it just then. He had walked right into view of Shivra as well. Distance. There is no real space between them right now. Difference. Shivra was probably analyzing Whisk with each passing fraction of a second.
"Ksaxa, just come with me back to the city. The last thing I want is for another person to die."
After Whisk said this, Ksaxa put his book away.
"Well, I guess you've backed me into a corner. You're determined to hold yourself hostage, aren't you? Well, fine. Let's leave before you get yourself killed."
Ksaxa walked past Whisk, which prompted Shen and him to follow. Shinaga was smelling the path they were walking before he'd step. He could pick up on something, but he wasn't sure what it was. There was a sense of danger that he could perceive, and was instinctively checking to make sure each step was not onto a trap, devised by nature or otherwise.
Let's get you back to Candy now,
Xaxa verbally prodded at Whisk.
So, what's your name?
Candy was cautiously curious.
Zero.
Zero?
Just Zero.
Okay.
Walking next to him, she felt a completely different atmosphere than when she'd walk with Whisk. It was then that she truly understood what his current absence felt like to her. Whisk and Shen were an air of comfort. Previously, she had only thought about how much she wanted to help him, but now she was missing his company. Zero picked up on her pondering look.
What's the matter, Sugar? Missing someone?
Don't call me Sugar.
Oh, so just the food, not the ingredients. Got it.
Candy's rage subsided with the thought of food. It had been too long since she last had access to a full kitchen and enough resources to make a proper meal. Walking a foreign land beside someone she didn't know, thinking about those she did and the things she normally would do, gave her a physical sensation. It was cold, as if a humid breeze on a sunless day had found its way through the protection she had given herself from such forces. Zero could see this as well. It was no surprise to him. He had given her little reason for trust, even from the moment they had met, though she seemed to not pay him much mind then. In fact, he realized she hadn't been paying him much mind now. This was probably the only reason she was willingly going along with him, he decided. Zero was no stranger to situations like this, though. In fact, the cold routine was even verging on the territory one might call comfort for him. He was relishing the journey now. In no significant period of time, he'd be able to converse with Gorik, and hopefully be another step closer to uncovering his past. As the two meandered along their path, the sound of gunshots resonated off the buildings, cracks and smacks amid loud pops and bangs. There was a firefight occurring as they were approaching. After this revelation, the two picked up their pace towards Fisher's Paradise. On the opposite side of Cimeterium, Officer Saf was carrying Officer Lamino from the gambler's house back to his squad car at the edge of the city to take to the hospital. Cern was just entering the city, avoiding the police as he came to a stop just inside the ridge floor village.
Who would have known the CPD were so active on the island?
Cern spoke to himself. Moving as if he were just an average resident of the village, he made his way to the main pathway. Using every trick he knew of, he attempted to make himself as undetectable as possible to blend in with the rabble. Despite the incoming storm and the looming sunset just around the corner, people, adults and kids alike, were still roaming. Alcoholics passed out or working their way to that conclusion slumped all along the buildings littering the main path.
Ah, now there's a sore thumb,
Cern declared in a pianissimo. His sights were fixed on a man walking upright, confidently, and with an even cadence, all of which were in stark contrast to the residents of the village. Alexander had been in the village for some time at this point, walking along and checking the addresses marked on each structure as he passed. The near instant travel time of his grand speed to the village was juxtaposed against the minute crawl of the hunt for the particular building he was searching out. Needles were scanning everything Alexander wasn't.
You're too exposed here. You're introducing too many variables to our situation.
Alexander ignored his desire to reply. Acknowledging his presence would only exacerbate the very thing Needles was pointing out, and they both knew it. It didn't matter anymore. The address on the next building was the one that Alexander had written down. Looking both ways, he checked who was watching, and then attempted to enter. It was locked. Cern kept a close eye on him as he tried to look as though he was just another drunk, collapsed on the side of the dirt road. Not even Needles singled Cern out as the only true worry. Alexander stepped aside as Needles used part of his body to pick the lock on the door. From Cern's perspective, it looked as though the door magically became unlocked, as Needles remained invisible. He derived that Alexander must be a Nen user, thinking,
this is going to be fun.
When Cern was sure he was out of sight, he used aura diffusion to keep a copy of himself where he sat, only this time moved more into the shadows to avoid detection or notice. Then, with the 10 minutes of increased Zetsu, he moved to infiltrate the very same building. Inside, Alexander looked around. As was to be expected, no one was there. The resident, Vivian Claude, was now deceased. In fact, this was only one of her homes. As Alexander had searched her eccentric manor, he had discovered locations of what some might consider vacation homes. Though for her, they were more like escapes to different cultures. Back when Vivian had lived here, the village was the top of the spectrum of class. It was the chandelier that hung above the artisan flooring that was cemeterium. Every residence was a jewel on a well-crafted asylum of prestige. The houses themselves are still vast, sprawling, and elite. Vivian had not visited in some years, possibly as she may have known of the unfortunate demise of the location of one of her past favorite homes. Once a myriad of colorful architectural flourishes, now a dusty heap used to trap the less fortunate instead of reward the most fortunate. Just another symptom of the death spiral that is Cowtip's economy, a whirlpool of dread and doubt. Alexander himself had doubts that he was even in the right place.
How could Vivian have lived in a place like this, with her wealth of high fashion tastes?
Questioned he upon finally witnessing the ridge floor village for himself. A confirmation was all he sought. Without extensive knowledge of the village's past, he'd be left guessing on the validity of the information he'd received. Searching the rooms for any signs of Vivian Claude's presence or even vague relation in the dark and dreary domicile. Embroideries and pendants, and finally a sign. The clue to search there was modest enough. In Miss Claude's other properties, there seemed to always be a dresser of one dark wood or another near the front entrance. Atop the dressers were various pictures of favored animals in mediums of paint, representing no being in particular. It was simply the shape that was desired, the homunculus of what could be a living thing. This was not what immediately triggered Alexander's ease. Inside, she always kept a pair of gloves in the top drawer for excursions out of the premises. The gloves were all identical in material. Even in the dark, he could find and feel the gloves, identifying their material, and confirming that this was in fact a residence of Vivian Claude.
After all this work, all this time, these vast distances, and we may have finally found the location.
He spoke to Needles.
Didn't you say that the last time?
Where shall I check first? The bedroom?
That's where she always keeps her true valuables after all.
Needles knew Alexander was privy to this knowledge, so he felt a bit silly reminding him. Needles, representing the opposite of Alexander's outlook on the world, would rather not succumb to the potential pitfalls that lie in wait should one allow themselves to be overcome with anticipation and imagery related to it. A skeptic at heart, he would rather not get Alexander's hopes up, especially after seeing numerous setbacks on their journey just to get this far. Still, to the bedroom they headed to search.
My father was a strong man, able to raise me on his own like this. He set aside any thoughts about what could be reasoned as my fault in the part of my mother's death. He accomplished so much with so little help. And now I have a chance to finally create my magnum opus. The tools will be all mine now.
He thought it best to stifle Alexander now.
Or it could be another empty house like the last one.
I've got a feeling this is the one. Any moment now and we'll see for ourselves the exquisite holding box in all its glory.
In the bedroom, Cern was in wait. He had managed to make it into the house through a back window undetected, as Needles' own paranoia was still focused on the diversionary aura diffusion set up beforehand. Listening to the conversation, he decided to act on what he had heard. Just before the two entered the room, Cern grabbed the box he assumed they were talking about and headed for the window. His footsteps were enough to trigger Needles, who then alerted Alexander. Even with Alexander's speed, Cern had already dove out for the window, and with no clear sight line of him as he fell, Alexander was forced to sprint to the window. Below, he had just witnessed Cern slash the throat of a passed-out drunk on the side of the road with one of his knives. As this occurrence concluded, a conjuration of Nen had appeared. Death's briefcase is a Hatsu of Cern's that can only be activated when someone has been killed by him. As Alexander and Needles followed out the window, Cern placed the holding box into Death's briefcase. Before they landed, it had disappeared.
What did you do?
Rage was seething through Alexander's teeth, hot breath seeping out from beneath his lips.
How about we play a little game?
A grin skewed Cern's speech, as the anger he was seeing was only delighting him further. Gorrick rounded the corner, about to head for the entrance behind Miles. Miles was still struggling with Achilles, who was better equipped for a fight. Facebreaker proved to be no match against a sword and shield. Even if he could pass them, with the armor Achilles was wearing, he wouldn't be able to land a hit on flesh. He accepted his fate, as Tulver had, and attempted to draw out the fight as long as possible. The sudden lack in fervor enraged Achilles. With a horizontal slash, his sword connected with Miles's side. It took just as much effort and strength to withhold his strength and momentum as it did to swing. The equivalent of pulling a punch, Achilles still wound up embedding the sword into his opponent. With the sword lodged between two ribs, Miles grabbed at Achilles's arm. Reading his opponent, he abandoned the sword. The strength that Miles possesses might be enough to break Achilles' arm with the right leverage and a good hold. He'd rather not take the risk. The fight was decided already. With blood streaming down his body, Miles would grow weaker with each passing second. Gorrick no longer needed to flank Miles. Now he could focus on Tulver. One thing did enter his mind. If Miles was willing to sacrifice his well-being to such an extent just for a chance at harming Achilles, what might Tulver do? It was a clear setup for a trap, and one which might equate to a suicide bombing, should the conditions be right. Inside the room, Gorrick had no idea what was happening. Entering would be extremely dangerous, as it was a step into the unknown. A negotiation would probably work best with Miles used as leverage. Gorrick started heading back towards Kasumi, who was still firing short, controlled bursts into the structure. Without word, she was showing him what she had discovered. The room was taking damage, considerably. With an increase in firepower, they might be able to break through. Tulver, still waiting inside, knew of the inevitable outcome the moment he heard the rounds connecting with the wall. He moved so as to avoid any potential stray shots. With the new strategy in mind, Gorrick controlled all five revolvers to begin firing, converging with Kasumi's shots. In no time at all, a hole began to form in the side of the casino. At this moment, the entire structure began to fade, as is a condition of instant casino. As the walls were fading, Gorrick and Kasumi ceased firing. Miles, now with weakened legs, turned and watched as Tulver grew visible. Achilles stood by and waited for any chance of Miles attempting an attack. When the walls were all gone, Tulver walked towards Gorrick. Seeing this, Kasumi walked into the open and kept her weapon trained on Tulver, should he try anything.
I'm beat. You've done well.
Tulver was at ease.
Will you cooperate?
Yes, officer, I will.
This was pleasant to Gorrick's ears. He'd seen many situations go south just in the final moments. He trusted Tulver's resolve to go peacefully. Kasumi lowered her weapon and started towards Miles, now sitting on the ground. As she stood near Achilles, she conjured Gaia. When Gaia appeared, Achilles took especial notice.
It's been a while there, Gaia.
He was energetic in his intonation.
Easy there, tough guy.
Gaia was playfully condescending.
Wouldn't want you to pull something now, would we?
Would it mean I'd get to have you work your magic on me too?
For you? I thought you didn't need my healing touch. You can handle that on your own.
Achilles leaned slightly forward.
Who said anything about healing?
Okay, you two. What did I say about getting to business?
Kasumi wanted to keep a handle on them.
What do you think I'm trying to do?
Achilles thought himself clever.
Great.
Kasumi tried to be as sarcastic as her voice would allow.
I'm sorry, Kasumi. We all know how Achilles can get in the way of business.
Gaia was comforting and warm towards Kasumi.
Maybe if you'd let us out a little more often.
Okay, you're done.
Kasumi immediately deconjured Achilles after speaking.
Thank you, dear.
Gaia then moved to Miles as the sword deconjured from where it was lodged into his body. Before healing, Kasumi asked of him,
What about you? Peacefully?
Miles glanced at Tulver.
Yes.
Just down the road, Zero and Candy had shown up to watch the end of the struggle.
There's Gorrick,
Zero declared to her, pointing him out.
Should we talk to them?
They seem busy. They'll probably head to the police station. We'll follow them there.
Great, back and forth.
It was a long day, and with much walking, Candy was getting tired. In an alleyway, watching the fight transpire was Maxwell. From his distant view, he saw as Gaia healed Miles to peak condition. Then, Gorik and Kasumi began escorting Tolvar and Miles to a squad car parked out of sight. Maxwell still felt like he owed them, but he was not sure how to proceed. He was again jobless. As this was occurring, Detective Blount had been following the path of Nen footprints throughout the city. Several trails led this way. Once he was in sight of Gorik and Kasumi, he stopped. Had he kept following the trails, one would have led right into the alleyway next to him, where Maxwell was standing, deep in thought. Blount breezed past him, only catching him out of the corner of his eye. He stopped walking, Maxwell now petrified.
Hey, you!
Maxwell couldn't decide whether or not to run. To run was to self-incriminate, but to stay meant being arrested if Blount had figured it out.
In the alleyway.
He didn't want to speak. Maybe Blount was referring to someone else.
I'm talking to you.
Blount was slightly peeved. This jolted a response from Maxwell.
Yes? Did you see anything just now?
No.
You mean the gunshots and everything? You were just looking over there.
I mean, yes.
Blount was less irritated now.
Did you happen to see anyone else with the two that showed up here?
Maxwell raced. If he lied again, Blount might realize it.
Yeah, but they went another direction. I don't know exactly where to, but...
Okay, thank you.
Blount took a step to leave.
Oh, I guess I should have you come down and make a statement at the station.
Maxwell gulped. He hoped that Blount would not have heard it, else his suspicions would assuredly rise.
Yeah, okay.
Maxwell was in for the long haul now. From a distance, much of these moments were being watched by a pair hidden within Fisher's paradise. Law and Jeremiah were formulating their next step towards their end goal. Amid all this fluster, in the distance, Xaxa and Whisk were walking along with Shen back towards Cimeterium. At this point in time, the sky was clear and the day still beating on. The sunset would be soon, but they still felt as though the warmth from the sun would last an eternity.
I tell you, I've never had anyone stick up for me like that. She's really assertive. Almost the complete opposite of me.
So Candy's gonna remain our topic of conversation?
Saxa was amused.
I mean, with Shen's cover of Ean, I was happy just to waltz out of there, but she made sure he wouldn't forget it.
Sometimes I make sure someone doesn't forget me either.
Really?
Whisk stopped rubbing Shen's back as he perked up to listen.
How so?
I take a chunk of them with me. Scars last a good while, you know.
Not... what I had in mind. Xaxa?
Yeah.
You ever killed anyone?
Oh, definitely. I try and avoid it, though. When I'm hungry, I usually kill to put my food out of its misery.
People or animals?
What's the difference?
Whisk looked at Shen.
Nothing. None that I can think of.
They were walking across a sprawling field of blades of grass, dancing in the slight breeze, soaking in the warmth just as they did. Smells drifted and dissipated. But the scent, or lack thereof, was fresh and natural. Despite this olfactory respite, Shen had seemed to find something. A vague lump in the field, a discoloration in the green horizon of the plain. Shen led them to it. Upon closer inspection, it appeared to be that of a muscular woman's body. Shinaga began sniffing the corpse.
Hey, don't eat that!
Whisk barked. Xaxa almost stopped Whisk short.
Were you talking to Shen? Or me?
Whisk ignored Xaxa's comment and got Shen away from the body. The island's fertile soil had given birth to rare flora. Little leaflets sprouting from thin vines intertwined with limbs and appendages of corpses, wrapping the body up. A red mossy lichen grew from blood and fluid and slowly covered exposed bone and calcified sludge. The humid air giving breath to its surface area as Bertha's body decomposed amid a miniature overgrowth where she lied.
Pity, really,
Xaxa elaborated.
To think of all the people she loved, that loved her. And she's gone now.
Whisk was clearly more emotionally impacted than Xaxa.
Guess we should tell someone.
Who would you want to be told about your death?
I don't really know. Might depend on how I died.
Someone you cared about, that cared for you.
Xaxa thought.
Well, in that case, I guess it would have to be my brother. He's really the only friend I have.
What about Liban?
Like I said, Liban probably thinks of me that way, but I don't really know what I'd call him. Ally for the moment, at least.
He glanced at Whisk, who was borderline stunned by Xaxa's callousness over his own mortality. Then he continued,
Besides, he'd probably gossip about the news to everyone, not that it'd matter at that point. I'd be dead.
Whisk looked back at her mangled remains.
Do you think she was a local or an outsider like us?
Does it matter?
Xaxa pulled out his phone.
Guess we should bury her.
Damn, got the machine. Hello, I'm just leaving an anonymous tip. There's a body. Wait, a woman's body in the fields outside of Cemeterium. Kind of tough to locate. But a walk through the middle of the grass should land you somewhere around here. I mean, her. I swear, I didn't kill her. No, wait, that makes it sound like I killed her. Hold on, she's been dead for a bit now. I'm sure forensics will confirm that. So, it might be better to look in daytime now that I think about it. She probably won't be going anywhere overnight, being dead and all. Well, good luck.
He proceeded to hang up.
Xaxa?
Whisk had heard the whole thing and was surprised with nearly every word that was spoken.
Are you capable of empathy for another human being? Of any form of love?
Without pause.
Sure. In fact, I treat everyone the very same way I wish to be treated, and have been consistently treated. She's not there anymore. That's just a collection of proteins arranged in such a way to be a body. One in poor shape, but still a body. For love. My brother's ability to experience any true intimate love was taken away. It would be arrogant and insulting if I should allow myself that privilege.
Whisk gave up.
Want to help me bury the body?
No, but I'll help anyways.
The two of them shuffled around as they wondered how to begin the process without tools. Using Nen could mean triggering the ire of Shivra, and digging with their hands could mean an arduous process. Whisk wanted to leave Shen out of it, as he didn't want to use his strengths in that way. Making small talk, Xaxa commented on the looks Whisk was giving Shen.
He's no normal dog, is he?
Whisk sighed.
What gave it away?
Some things you can tell. Plus you mentioned using Een.
Where do I begin?
Xaxa pulled out his book.
Wherever you want.
With my family dead and no other relatives to stay with, I decided to pack up my bags and leave with Shen. We hitched rides, hiked, you name it. Shinaga was my only family left. We were searching for a new life, a new start. We traveled and traveled, and stayed in locations until we were kicked out for the vagabonds we were. It didn't matter what hardships we faced, we were together. We supported each other. York New City was where we wound up. I thought the opportunities would be endless there, but all I found was a barrier to entry. Entry to life. Money this, money that. I couldn't afford to live there. I couldn't even afford to die there. Everything was just another cost, and everyone was just trying to avoid those costs. No one would hire a vagabond who had no recent track record. People walking by would rather believe you were just trying to game the system, to earn without effort, because they were too busy trying to do the same in their own way. Their lives were ruled by costs and payments, so they slaved over earning anything they could to avoid ending up like Shen and I.
Sounds about right.
Xaxa was staring out at the site of Cemeterium from where they were.
So, I did my best with Shen. To just try and be comfortable, if no one else would let us back into life as we knew it. But the cruel nature of dogs is that they don't need the opportunity to live as long as us people. They spend more of their life on others, and get the chance to take their nap earlier. Lucky dogs. In his old age, his immune system was weakened. He caught a disease, and I couldn't afford the medicine for him. I couldn't afford to put him down either. Couldn't afford it financially or mentally. And he left me behind.
Xaxa stopped writing.
Whisk.
So that was it. It was me York New City had won. Those last few days with Shen are seared into my mind. I wanted to go like he did.
Shen was sitting against Whisk, trying to ease his pain.
So I let go of everything. I fasted and fasted until I would get my turn to go. But someone wouldn't let me. He found me, healed me, In the process, whatever he did, it opened up my micropiles. I was awakened. When I became proficient enough, I made weapons. I wanted to fight. But when I became in control, I...
Shinaga.
Xaxa was staring at Shen beside him.
The best I could. He's a different being than me now. He'll never go away. And if he dies, I go too. I don't want to go on without him ever again.
Because you conjured him, you can use Ian.
Anyone who Shen recognizes as an owner can use Ian on him.
And your sword?
Can't kill. It'll break if it would be a killing blow.
I'm sorry to make you go through that. Does Candy even know?
Haven't had the chance.
Whisk nervously chuckled.
Well, if she doesn't want to pry, then it's her loss.
I don't get you, Kasaxa.
Would it matter if you did?
No, I suppose not.
Good. Then let's eat this bitch and head back.
He nudged Bertha's severed body with his foot.
Kasaxa!
She's already split in two. Come on, you tried Candy's cooking.
That was actual cooking. This is the opposite of that.
Your loss.
Don't eat her, okay? This time I am talking to you.
Xaxa shrugged. A little ways away, Dahlia was strolling through the meadow. She was far enough away that she didn't hear Whisk and Xaxa arguing, and she was nearing the forest. Close enough to hear the trees creak, a man walked out to confront her.
What are you doing here, girl?
Stay back. I'll defend myself.
You came to me.
I'm warning you.
Shen, in the distance, noticed the conversation. Whisk and Xaxa did not, but they did take notice of Shen's reaction. Shivra Nyal was questioning Dahlia as she had unintentionally approached him. He spoke again, heeding her warning.
Will you kill me?
If I have to, then yes.
Then I have no choice.
Shivra took a step towards her. As an immediate reaction, Dahlia used connected rope to turn her Nen into a whip-like tool. It was an ability based on her childhood pastime of wrangling beasts, but she'd yet to use it in an actual fight. This would be her chance to test herself and her ability. With a swing, she used her left arm to lasso Shivra's arm. The defensive orb was not deployed. With her right, she formed a fist and attempted to pull herself or him toward her to punch him. Shivra, however, was already mid-attack. As soon as she had lassoed his arm, he pulled her towards himself, and using a similar tactic, punched her left arm with his left fist. This immediately severed her arm, destroying much of the limb in the process. Enough concussive force followed that Dahlia was sent tumbling backwards in agony, shrieking with death in her voice. Xaxa and Whisk were riding Shinaga in his transformed state to the location where this was occurring. Whisk instantly took notice of the girl, who appeared around Candy's age. For a second, he imagined Candy in her place and sprung forth to action.
Take care of her. Shen and I will handle this.
Xaxa shouted to Whisk as he ran over.
This is a battle for beasts, not you,
he thought to himself. Xaxa used his right arm to chop off his left arm. Shinaga was now siphoning from Xaxa as he was the closest person that had pet him.
Honestly, Shen, I'd like to try out a strategy where we let him pet you and you can drain him. But this one's not going to go down that way. Don't get close to him. If you go, so does Whisk. And I don't want either of you to leave me alone with this guy, okay?
Shen took off, running a wide circle around Shivra. Xaxa launched his floating arm at Shivra, but it was quickly swatted away, far off into the distance.
Shit! At that distance, all it can do is fly straight back to me.
Shivra was now focusing on Shen. Whisk was now by Dahlia's side as she screamed,
Is there anyone that you can call for help?
Dahlia fumbled for her phone with her one good arm while writhing. At first, she tried with her left hand, but with no haptic feedback, she was reminded of the permanence of the situation and tears uncontrollably welled. As she got her phone out of her pocket, a piece of paper slipped out with a number on it. Whisk took it and dialed. As this was happening, Anya and Virgil were walking with Law and Jeremiah. This was the moment when Anya's phone rang, which led to them leaving. Whisk had explained to her the emergency situation, with Dahlia's painful cries nearly drowning out his voice on the phone.
Whisk, I need your help.
Shen was just barely dodging Shivra's invisible attacks. Shen had exceptional senses, even through Ian, lightly. This was how he was able to detect needles and needles he. They happen to share a bond, a connection based on the similarity between their births. Shivra's attacks look to Shen to be shaped much like giant arms and weapons.
Hang on till your friend gets here!
Whisk yelled to Dahlia, conjuring Beast Sword. Xaxa demanded before Whisk even arrived at him.
Cut off my other arm.
What?
The sword won't break, it won't kill me. You said it yourself, that thing can't kill.
Whisk swung and chopped off Xaxa's right arm, giving him another weapon to use. With it, he flew his arm at incredible speeds over to Shen and grabbed his fur. Then he used Yin to disguise Shen. Shivra was having a tough time attacking him then, as Xaxa was also able to lift Shen into the air with his floating arm. However, Xaxa was now left defenseless, as his primary mode of attack, his mouth, would not be useful against the likes of Shivra, much like Law's master hand-to-hand skills could not be applied.
It's almost like he's equally potent in both emission and transmutation,
Whisk observed. Xaxa thought on the chart of Nen efficiencies Leiden had shown him.
That's it. Whisk, don't ever let him hit you directly with his fists. He's an enhancer.
After saying this, he and Whisk spread apart to make sure they wouldn't be caught within the same attack. Their goal was to buy time for Dahlia's friend to show up. Anya and Virgil were on their way, but it'd be a while before they could get to where the fight was occurring. Without Shinaga's transformed speed or Alexander's natural ability, neither of them could get here quickly. They could and were, however, flying using Virgil's ability, majorly reducing time. With Shen invisible in the air, Shivra smacked at them with a massive attack, blanketing the sky with invisible Nen. This sent Shen and Xaxa's arm flying across the island.
Shen!
Xaxa paid more attention to Whisk. With his arm being launched, it would automatically return to him from whatever distance. But if Shen was killed, Whisk would drop right there. Instead, he still stood. Before either of them could react, Shivra was directly traveling towards Xaxa. With his arm cocked back, Shivra was swinging a punch straight into him. But instead of connecting with Xaxa, it connected with Whisk, who had dove in the way of the attack. Before anyone could discern what had happened, Xaxa and Whisk were launched across the island as well, differently from Shen and Xaxa's arm. Shivra walked over to Dahlia.
Still want to kill me?
Dahlia, tears down her face, shook her head.
No.
That's what I thought.
And he walked back into the forest as Anya and Virgil showed up. Anya was shocked while Virgil was impressed. Quite a distance away, Xaxa and Whisk had landed, tumbling, on the ground. A forest of trees now partitioned themselves off from Shivra and the meadowy plain they were traveling. They were now near the location where Whisk and Candy had set up camp when they arrived, the place where Xaxa first met them. Xaxa wiggled up to a sit, broken leg, broken ribs, a sore spine, bruised organs, and major blood loss. Luckily, one of his arms had been launched the same direction as him, so it would be returning soon. The other would be another couple of minutes, even with its speed. Xaxa looked over at Whisk. Whisk was lying face down, a hole extending from his chest out through his back, pieces of spinal cord exposed, and peaks of his digestive tract in view. Xaxa hobbles over to him, balancing carefully with his wounded legs and no arms. Blood turned the dirt from their impact site into mud. All Xaxa could think about was how he was just alive, moving, thinking, speaking, feeling, not more than a few minutes ago.
Oh, Whisk, I'm sorry.
One of Xaxa's severed arms came in, and he helped himself up with it. One leg was just a minor sprain, while the other was a clean break. Xaxa picked up a damaged lung ejected from Whisk's body with one of his floating, detached arms. The blood loss he was experiencing would begin to take a toll on his health. Dizzy, he ate the lung and reattached the arm that was present. The other would be back in time for the effect to still be active, allowing it to be reattached. Xaxa knelt down beside Whisk and flipped him over.
I guess it's not polite to play with your food, huh?
He tried to joke, but the sadness that was infecting him crept through his body as he looked into Whisk's lifeless eyes. His other arm came flying in, and he let it attach. He would need both arms to begin digging a grave, even without tools, in his diminished state. An hour or two went by as he dug and gently placed the body down. It was with great pain that he slid the dirt back over the top of him. He took out his book and then wrote on the last page he was writing on about Whisk.
Deceased.
Reluctantly, he took out his phone and dialed, getting a machine again.
I'm calling again.
He looked over at the mound of fresh dirt.
There's a second body.